in the church office here at Brew, we have had a veritable infestation of fruit flies. It's the kind of thing that you don't really notice if you're frantically running around, which I'm usually doing, until you pause, and all of a sudden they come to greet you, hovering in your face. And some of you who may have been here in meetings this week have been sitting in the conference room the whole time we're doing something like this. And I think that if someone came to our congregation and did not know us, they might believe that we were doing some sort of charismatic, kind of moved by the spirit, convoluted dance situation. It's been that intense. And it hopefully is under control at this point. We have little pots of vinegar sitting all over the building, so we may have less flies and more stink, but whatever it takes, we're trying. And the whole experience of the fruit fly epidemic of 2011 at the Bull Run Unitarian Universalists led our office administrator, Tina Cox, to recall a memory from some years ago when a dear friend of hers, now a dear friend of hers, was moving to Manassas from some other part of the country. She didn't have any friends here. She didn't know anybody. She was coming from far away, and she positively, this friend of Tina's, could not stop talking about what an amazing place Manassas, Virginia is. And eventually, Tina engaged in some conversation with this woman, and some background here is probably important, that this good friend of hers happened to move to Manassas at a time in the early 70s where it was a really hot summer, and we were right in the middle of the greatest fruit fly epidemic to strike this area until our church offices this week. And so Tina asked this woman, what is it? What is it that you love about this place? And she said, she talked about how she fit right in here and it just felt so much at home. And Tina wanted to know, what is so unique and special about this, our fair city? And her friend said it was positively the friendliest place she'd ever been, what with everyone waving all the time. And she felt at home here. And she loved it here. And she was less lonely here than any place she'd ever been before. Not necessarily because we Manassans were actually so much purer of heart or even more genuinely friendly than people in other places, but because they spent all their time waving away fruit flies, and in the process, this town just happened to give her a warmer welcome than she ever could have imagined, and exactly what her whole soul cried out for. And I would be remiss if I didn't state that it does kind of matter what people's intentions are. It does matter whether neighbors are inherently friendlier in one place or another, if people's hearts are genuinely in the right place, but it also matters that this lady felt welcome, no matter what, no matter why, no matter how. It matters that something those people did, for whatever reason, pure or simple, false or true, something those people did made a difference for her, and I shall have to ask Tina, but I really hope that that friend of hers has never left Manassas, and I hope it has everything to do with those fruit flies. This week, it's possible that we might just be the friendliest congregation in town, and I don't care if it's for pure reasons, or innate joy at seeing one another's faces again, or because we would really rather not eat a bug. Any way you slice it, somebody might feel at home here, and that's all right by me. Because my point is, what we do matters. Not only do you never get a second chance at a first impression, but you can never do over any given moment ever again. And it is what we choose to do with those moments, these ones that are given us, that changes lives. Not necessarily the background thinking and the philosophical thinking and the reading and the theologizing that go into leading up to what we do, but what we do that matters. I don't care why you're waving at me. Just wave. and I'll feel like you care. And I might wave back. And even if you don't care, you might end up caring anyway. I don't care if it's the butterfly's wings that flutter over the ocean that moves the boat that guides you to my front door, or if you just showed up to bring me some banana bread and welcome me to the neighborhood. Either way, I'm hungry and I'm glad you came. Either way, what we do matters. What we believe is not the end of our searching, but only the very beginning of the journey. And in our reading from Hafiz today, a man comes up to the wise teacher, just positively dripping with anxiety and yearning for answers. He has apparently had some really spectacular visions. I mean, some crazy stuff. Think as big as you can get. He is seeing the skies opening and angels descending. He's got the whole schmear. Great visions of God, the reading says. And the man, of course, is dripping with anxiety because, after all, what would you do if you were having great visions of God? Get thyself to therapy fast? Walk up to the wisest person you know and ask him what the hell was going on? Simply watch and learn, or hit your knees in gratitude? What would you do? This man appears to have done a little of all of the above, culminating finally in his pleading hope for confirmation from the smartest guy in town. He goes up to Hafiz and tells him, "Please tell me, teacher, wise ones, are these wondrous dreams true?" And Hafiz just looks at him sort of funny, and he asks some seemingly random and inane question about goats. "How many goats do you have?" he says. And can you imagine how that would annoy the living tar out of this man who has come to him for answers? Who gives a hoot about goats? Why are you grilling me? What the heck are you talking about? I am speaking of divine visions, man. I am talking about a shining throne and 1,000 angels singing some major revelation-style stuff, and you're sitting here talking to me about goats? And the teacher keeps on asking about goats. All 62 that the man owns, and his wives, and the rose bushes, and the babies, and the mom, and the dad holding on to their golden years, and the other parents, and the Girl Scout troop, and the turtle crossing the road in front of your car, and the birds that come to your feeder in winter. And at the end of it all, he says, "You asked if your visions were true. And I tell you that they are if they make you more human, more kind to every creature and every plant that you know." So is God in his fiery throne, or Allah shining down from heavens, or the angels singing, or the impending arrival of your chosen Messiah, is any of it that you may see, is any of it, capital T, true? "You tell me," the teacher asks. "How does it compel you to live? And if it compels you to live in love, then glory, hallelujah, we have ourselves a prophet. But if it compels you to isolate yourself, to hate, to fear, to draw boundaries that divide and hurt, then get yourself some better visions, buddy, because these ones just won't do. What we do matters. And what we believe is not the end of our searching, but only the very beginning of the journey." There was a time in my life, I would argue probably the longest stretch of my life, when I really knew, not just felt or perceived or pondered it, but I really knew in my soul that the most important relationship I had in my whole life was between God and I. I've always had a very internal sort of relationship to religion and faith, and most of all, a very internal relationship to the source of all those things we sometimes choose to call that much-debated word that begins with a capital G. Even though, as Sartre said, that our God resembles our words about as much as the dog star resembles a dog, I think that's helpful to think about God. But God and I, that force for which we have no words, God and I, throughout my adolescence and my young adulthood and most of my life, we were tight. We were good buddies. And I listened. I really listened to what I perceived her to be telling me. I can honestly say that my good and challenging and honest buddy never led me astray. Partly because my good buddy spoke not only with the wisdom of the ages, from the throne of the Almighty, etc., etc., but with the voice of humble truth and genuine contrition when I had messed something up. God's was the voice that told me to get it together when I was acting a fool. God's was the voice that told me to get out when things were dangerous. And God's was the voice that called me to go to church, to go to seminary, and to do this work. God's was the voice that said I didn't have to be quiet when I'd rather be loud, that I had a calling, and when no one else understood, indeed, when the entire rest of the world said no, 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 it was God who said yes to the idea that I might have enough in me to pursue such a calling in the first place. For most of my life, it was almost tangible, this relationship between me and my good God, my friend, my guide. I even once, to a group of colleagues, described it thusly, that God was sort of like my really dramatic boyfriend who required a hell of a lot of attention but never let me down. And now? Well, God's not my dramatic boyfriend anymore. I'm not listening to the sounds of the leaves and the trees trying to discern her voice. I'm not as acutely aware of his presence prodding me along. These days, God is like an old friend whom I hear from every once in a while. I'm not mad at her when things go wrong. I'm not turning over all the glory to her when things go right. I'm just going about my life, checking in from time to time, occasionally closer than ever, and often a little wistful for the way things were back when. My calling these days comes most immediately from you, from my family, from the depth of my experience, and the responsibilities of being in relationship to a beloved community. And the truth is that I don't know which is better. I don't know which is true. A very present God guiding, teaching, speaking in my life, or a God indwelling in each of us, a force less mystical and more incarnational, less trailing mists of glory, and more outstretched hands to hold my own. I don't know if I've lost my faith or I've gained it. And the thing is, the glorious, blessed thing is, it probably doesn't matter. It's not the precise doctrine that we hold, or our understanding of the divine that we cleave to. It's what we do that matters, and what we believe is not the end of our searching, but only the very beginning of our journey. I experienced God a different way then. I experienced divinity in a new way now. In a decade, I will likely have a whole nother sermon to preach to you about my changing understandings of God. And none of it is wrong. Provided, however, that I listen to the voice of calling. If it comes through a mystical connection to the source of all, or in the voice of the person next to me, what matters is that I'm listening and that my faith, whatever it may be, guides me, guides us toward gentleness, humility, compassion, and peace. And as our Unitarian Universalist Association President Peter Morales wrote in the latest edition of the UU World Magazine, which, by the way, if you don't get it, you sign the membership book and then you get the UU World Magazine. There's a plug, you know. As Peter Morales said, we must realize that religion is more about what we feel and experience than about our opinions. Our religion is about what we love passionately, about how we aspire to live, about what moves us to the very center of our being. It is not about you agreeing with me. This thing we do is not about me agreeing with you. It's not about our theologies meshing or our political affiliation being the same. It's not about persuading ourselves or others that they ought to darn well believe or not believe in the same faith framework of faithlessness or holy blessing that we ourselves hold. I gave up arguing about whose perspective on God and the church is better or more correct a long time ago. And in fact, this thing we do, this searching, is not even about me agreeing with me in an unchanging faith statement that will never alter for all time. What it's about is deep conversations that try to get at what we're passionate about, why we love this world, and how we're willing to serve it. A conversation in which we simply ask one another how we intellectualize the mystery does nothing to give us a real clue about how we live our lives. And I can hear, because I have my own visions, which are criticisms of my sermons, I can hear percolating up a criticism of this sermon. It comes either from my brain or from yours, I don't know. And the criticism is this. Am I saying that it doesn't matter what we believe? Sort of. Kind of. A little, but not really. I'm saying that what we believe only matters if we examine it in the context of how we live our lives. And the right place to start a conversation among people who respect one another's worth and dignity is not the question, what do you believe? But rather, something more like, what do you love, and how do you aspire to live? To put it in a different and much too academic way that I will impose on you anyway, it's like this. There is no independent and self-existent capital T truth of our beliefs that exists separately from their consequences. If there is nobody living out the practices of some faith system might as well not exist at all. It isn't real unless we live it. And the teacher has no way of telling you if your vision is true or not. All we can do is evaluate how your visions, your truths, your faith statements impact the actual life you are currently living right this moment. Clara Barton is the founder of the American Red Cross, and she was a universalist. She believed with all her heart and soul in a loving God who would not damn any man or woman to eternal suffering, but instead emanated love to all people, no matter what. And it was her belief in that kind of God that led her to emulate that kind of love, which is why, when she entered the battlefields of the Civil War, not far from the ground we are standing on right now, she tended the wounds of Yankee and rebel alike. Blue and gray made no difference in the eyes of either a universalist God or the American Red Cross, and she lived her faith. What she believed was the beginning of what she did. And how could we, if we could reverse time and have a conversation with Clara Barton, how could we begin to understand that kind of a life? Do we start with an academic dissertation on universalism and our tradition's long-standing contention that divine love is the source of all of our living and draws us up like some holy God love vacuum until we shall all be part of the universal whole again? No. We start by looking at her life, at what she did, at what she did not do, how she risked that life over and over again, and from that we might conclude, near as we can tell it, that her theology was real and true and good in this world, even if we'll never know the truth of it in the world to come. So what I'm saying is, how do you treat your goats? How did you treat your husband this morning? What did you do when the turtle was smack in the middle of the road and you were late for work? What of the rose bushes in your backyard? The kids playing ball in the neighborhood? The person in the pew next to you? How do you treat your goats? Let's start there. And then we can dig back behind those actions, that lived experience. We can dig back behind it to the theories, the reasons, the theological ruminations and rejections that dwell beneath our doing. Then we must do the work. And if we don't like what we see, those goats aren't faring so well. We must reimagine a belief system that can manifest itself into a bit of tending for those blessed creatures. Let's just start there and work our way back. Because what we do matters. And what we believe is not the end of our searching, but only the beginning of the journey. And I do not care if you are waving at me because there are gnats in your face or because you are genuinely happy to see me. I'm just glad you waved. And in this moment, that is enough. Enough at least for a beginning.